On this edition of Thinking Biblically, we welcome back Avner Bosky from Israel, and we're going to be talking about settler violence, the Druze people and Syria, and Mike Huckabee. Welcome to Thinking Biblically. My name is Alan Gilman. Thinking Biblically is a podcast dedicated to exploring how all of Scripture speaks to all of life. Before I introduce my guest, I want to remind everyone to please, if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to my YouTube channel. And also, don't forget to like and to share, review. All this really, really helps. Avner Bosky has been a regular on Thinking Biblically, helping us to understand what's been going on in Israel and the Middle East. He's been doing that here even before the terrorist invasion of Israel on October the 7th, 2023. Originally from Montreal, just like myself, Avner is a Canadian-Israeli Messianic Jewish teacher. He's a writer and musician who provides an insightful, biblically-based view of God's heart for Israel and the Middle East. I encourage everyone to sign up, if you haven't done so already, for Avner's newsletter, and how to do so will be included in the description. Welcome back, Avner. It's so good to see you.
It's good to be here with you again, Mr. Allen.
So from where I'm sitting, and far, far away from you, and by the way, we're recording this on Wednesday morning, my time here in Ottawa, Canada. It's July the 23rd, and it is, keeping track here, it is day 656 of the war. So from where I'm sitting, things look like they become crazier than ever and more complicated than ever. What are you seeing?
There's so many things going on. I have to say, what do I see about what? We've got Gaza, we've got Syria, we've got Iran, we've got Qatar.
We've got Huckabee. We're going to talk about Huckabee and his comments eventually. So you pick.
Let's start with Huckabee.
Okay.
He's an American.
Yeah, just so... Do you want to give some background about who he is and what he's doing and what he's saying and why in the world is he saying it?
Sure. Mike Huckabee is a American. He's a Pentecostal preacher background, plays bass, country music. Met him. I've talked with him. He's a good friend of Ricky Skaggs, who's a friend of ours. He has a daughter who has become also governor of Arkansas. He was governor. I think she is now. He's a strong believer, has a real heart for the Jewish people, usually strikes a biblical balance in the things that he says. He was in the news recently. He's now ambassador to Israel. And he was in the news recently because he was asked to pay a call on a church site near Ramallah that had a fire happening there. And everyone in the news said that it was a bunch of settlers who had set fire to a Christian church and that these were bad people. Turns out that that wasn't the case at all. Turns out that it's an old building made of stone. There's nothing of wood. Hasn't been lived in for hundreds of years. It's a Byzantine church, so that brings you back to about 400 AD. There was no fire there at all. There was a fire outside the precincts there of some weeds which had burnt across from a stairway leading up to that site. And based on security cameras and stuff, it turns out that settlers were trying to put out the fire. It was a small fire, but it was not a church burnt down. It was not an attack, and it wasn't that. Now, where the fire came from, it's hard to say. They haven't been able to figure out where the fire came from, but certainly it was not what was communicated. Now, when he came there, he said to burn down churches is a very bad thing. And then it came out, of course, that it wasn't settlers who had burnt down a church and the church wasn't burned down. So that's one thing. Another thing is that in Israel, we have our own unique political system, which owes to the benefit of having both Turks and British people in charge here at various times in history. So there's a lot of beyond the average difficulties. So we have a Ministry of the Interior in Israel. Usually that portfolio goes to an ultra-Orthodox party, usually the Shas or Sephardic Torah Guardians Party. And these people, of course, don't really like Messianic Jews, and they're not that excited about evangelical Christians either. And they have, over the time in history, we are aware of various instances where things have been done where, like, passports have been not renewed or people haven't been given visas and stuff. We know some of this firsthand. So what happened here, it seems, is that there are visas given to like three different groups. I think Assemblies of God is one of the groups, and two other groups. I'm trying to remember which they were.
Well, Christian Missionary Alliance.
Christian Missionary Alliance. These are long-term. Like the CMA has been here before Israel. They came here like in 1905. Assemblies of God also came here during the British times. Or just afterwards. And so they have pastors here, like a Christian, where you'd have the King's congregation. There's some other congregations. So some of these groups then, they need to get visas for a certain amount of people who are working here. Whatever they're doing, it could be congregational, it could be humanitarian work, it could be actually PR for among evangelicals about how to support and encourage the state of Israel. So, but as far as the ultra-Orthodox parties, they're not always very friendly, and sometimes they look upon these people as not friends.
Right, and these are visas that are more, they're long-term visas.
Yes.
And yeah. As you already alluded to, there's this precedent that goes back, what, even before the establishment of the modern state of Israel in 48, where these religious workers would be able to get these longer term visas for whatever is doing. And my understanding is that there was always like a limited number of these allotted, and there's all these various
rules. Well, of course, you know, Baptists, Convention of Israel was the third one. Every country has a right to say how many foreign workers they want. Like if Russian Orthodox Church wanted to send 10,000 priests to Ottawa to convert all the Ottawanians into Russian Orthodoxy, I'm sure the Canadian government would have certain visa limitations. The issue would be, are they doing this because of the fact that they have personal religious convictions or because the law says something? And it's more the first one where there would be, we don't like these people, we don't believe what they're doing, we consider they're all going to try to turn Jews into Gentiles, et cetera, et cetera. They're going to give money, that type of thing. So certainly Jews have suffered for like 1,800 years from Christian anti-Semitism, and sometimes ultra-Orthodox Jews remember that and say, you know, maybe we can balance the equation a little bit. So evidently there's been stuff going on behind the scenes where visas have not been renewed, or they've been told you have to give us total idea of how you spend money, what you do, what you believe, and you know how you go, how you cook your spaghetti, and it's, they've been delayed. And so what's happened is Caleb Myers, who is Messianic Jewish believer involved in law and politics here, has been representing some of these cases and the go-between toward Mike Huckabee. And Mike came out and said, basically, hey, this is not fair. This is not according to agreements. We've been working privately to try to solve these issues, and you're still actually moving with prejudice against these groups. We could potentially do the same to you and limit, let's say, ultra-Orthodox religious groups from coming to America. That wouldn't be nice. So let's solve it. And within 2-3 days after some headlines, it was officially solved. So that's the background behind it. It's not, I mean, these things have been going on for years. I'm aware of these things personally since 1985. and they've gone back since the 50s. And it's part of the thing. It's part of what's involved in this incredible ingathering, where you put all these different Jews together with all their different beliefs, and hopefully they're all going to keep the law just like they do every day in Canada and America.
I haven't seen the report about this being resolved. If
it takes longer for news to get to Canada.
Yeah.
I think the internet is slower.
Yes, if you see anything, you could send me a link to that. I'll make sure.
Jerusalem Post okay. Yesterday.
Okay, I'll check that out. And one of the things I do also want to clarify, if I was better at this, I'd have the quote right in front of me, but Huckabee was apparently was seeming, he sounded like he was lumping together normal tourism with these visa issues, and that he was going to announce a warning to Americans about Israel being unfriendly. And whether he misspoke or the news wasn't reporting properly, again, the issue is about these longer term visas, not regular tourism.
Learning how to read news media is an art. And usually newspapermen are interested in screaming headlines. And sometimes you read the headline and then the article and they're not the same. And in this case, one would have to read very carefully. He didn't say that. But there are those who phrased it in that way to make for a strong headline. But definitely he was raising an issue that in most cases diplomats try to do behind the scenes. And he was bringing it out in front because he had gotten nowhere that way. And probably, as a good diplomat, he wouldn't have done anything without checking with the State Department back in Washington.
Okay. Could we focus on Syria for a little bit? Syria and the Druze people, not the Jewish people.
The conversation would become more serious, you're saying.
I don't have a response to that.
That's good.
Yeah. I love puns. Go ahead.
There's Druze and there's Jews. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, there's one Israeli podcast, news podcast I listen to, and the main person was going so out of her way every time she would say Druze, not to be confused with Jews.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, most people don't know who the Druze are. Some of us, if we were girls, which is not me, grew up reading the book of Nancy Druze, but this is a totally different issue here. So the Druze basically are you could call it a breakaway group from Islam. Islam is not always tolerant of people who don't hold the line. So you have various groups like the Alawis, which would be the Syrian leadership in times past. That would be the Assad family, their Alawis. They were influenced by the Shiites. Most of your listeners or watchers might know that there are two basic streams of Islam. One is Sunni, it's about 80%, and one is Shiite, like Iran, which is about 20%. They've had a war dealt with succession, whether it would be bureaucrats or descendants of Muhammad. The descendants of Muhammad would be Shiite Ali, from Ali and Hussein, and the Sunni would be the power brokers of the Rashidun Caliphate. So the head of Iran is a basically Shiite state, and the Alawis and the Druze in Syria and a little bit in Lebanon, a little bit in Iraq, but mostly in Syria. They kind of split from Islam in the Shiite split. They were a subdivision of the Shiite split. And so there was a guy whose name is Al-Hakim bin Amr Allah, who was the sixth Fatimid Caliph around 1000 AD. And we could get into that. How come there's caliphs? If you're dealing with Shiites, that's a different issue. But anyway, Caliph Al-Hakim was famous for many Christians, but they don't know it. He was the guy who desecrated the Church of the Holy Sepulchre around 1000. And that, in fullness of time, was the official reason for the Crusades. He forced Jews to wear specific distinguishing clothing, like, you know, hats and stuff, and Christians to pull crosses around on their backs. So he was not exactly an ecumenical person, but some Islamic sources would say that he was a nice man. So anyway, Al-Hakim in Egypt, that's where the head of the caliphate was, or at least one of them. And there's a, it's a whole Islamic history thing, but basically he was kind of in Egypt. And a guy came who was also of the same trend of Shiite Islam, Ismaili Islam, and his name was Hamza ibn Ali ibn Ahmad. And he came from Khorasan, which is in Iran. And he began to preach a form of Islam, of Shiite Islam, which was called Unitarian, but not like Canadian Unitarians. Very different thing, like the unity of Allah, no characteristics, no expressions, no personalities. And Muwahidun, it's called. And then there was another preacher from Cairo who came. He came to Cairo, rather, from Bukhara, which is Central Asia. And his name was Muhammad bin Ismail Nashtakin al-Darazi. And al-Darazi became Duruzi, and then the area became Jabal Daruz, which is the mountains of the Druze enclave. There's about a million Druze in the world, between 800 and 1,000 and a million. Most, 40% of all Druze are in Syria, a little less in Lebanon, and a little less in Israel. Some live in LA, but mostly they're in the Middle East. And the Druze have certain beliefs that other Muslims would say are heretical, like they believe that a man is going to give birth to a deliverer. And so they wear pants, baggy pants, in case this deliverer pops out when the man's going to the bathroom. They believe in reincarnation. And so there's a fixed number of Druze souls. And if you die, then your soul goes to the next Druze person who's born. Because of the persecution against them, which has been very heavy, they ended up being very good at defending themselves, warriors, and they ended up not being an outreach people. So they're not like Islam with jihad, convert or die. They're not like Mormons knocking on your door. They basically live in their villages. And so, and they tend to be loyal to the country if the country is strong enough. So in Lebanon, they would have followed, but Lebanon, of course, is a mess. So they're independent in the Jabal Daruz over there, the Shuf Mountains. In Syria, they've tended to try to be quiet and not get in the way of Assad. But now, oh, and in Israel, they're part of the Israeli army. They're considered totally equal citizens. I've worked in the army with Druze, they're very nice people. And they tend to be very positive toward Israel. So what happened in Syria with the collapse of Assad, the ISIS or ISIL or Islamic State group, which was hanging in the northeast of Syria that America was trying to suppress but hasn't, started coming down. And they began to fight against Assad, whom they hated because he's an Alawi. Okay, so they hate the Kurds, they hate the Druze, they hate the Alawis, all of them equally. They call them dogs. You can see videos, unfortunately, of people being murdered and raped and run over in the past couple of weeks where they're saying takfir, Allahu Akbar. In other words, you're an unbeliever and Allah is greatest, greater actually in Islam, in Arabic. And so they've been literally since January. This group now is in charge of Syria. Okay, this is the Julani group. It used to be called the Hayat al-Tahrir al-Sham, which means the group for the liberation of the Levant of Syria. And they are Al-Qaeda. They were a sworn member of Al-Qaeda. And the head, Julani, sworn member of Al-Qaeda. They changed the name, and they've been getting support from Germany, Saudi Arabia, $4 billion just today, America, France. These are Al-Qaeda people. So they've been guilty of documented and available terrible, terrible crimes of rape, torture, murder of women, children, kind of like October 7th, kind of like 9/11. So they said, oh, we've changed, but they haven't changed. This is a terrible thing where people who are interested in developing financial investments in Syria and using Syria as a kind of a bridge between the East and the West are willing to turn a blind eye to Al-Qaeda with a new name in Syria, like they turned a blind eye to Hitler prior to World War II. A lot of American British firms were invested in Hitler. And same thing is happening right now.
You mentioned
that's my introduction.
That's the introduction. So just to clarify one thing, when you mentioned their full name and you translated, you referred to Levant and then you said Syria, but the Levant is like from Syria all the way to the border of Egypt, right?
Yeah, it's a non-Arabic word. It's a Western word to describe the area of Syria, maybe a little bit of Turkey. It depends, stuffing on the side if you don't like Turkey.
Oh, yeah. Wow. But it's the, but and there is their agenda still that whole, to take over that whole area? Is that a
jihad's agenda is to take over the whole world.
Right.
They're all very clear about that. And so Turkey is actually one of the main bankrollers of Gulani. Qatar is another one of the main bankrollers. Now you have to add Egypt, Germany, France, Saudi Arabia, and America. They're all giving money to Al-Qaeda. Now, Al-Qaeda was originally set up by America, or at least given a big boost, to fight against the Russians in the Afghan war. So this is nothing new, but it would have been nice if people in the West learned something from what happened there, because these are 9/11 people. And the people who America helped in Afghanistan ended up attacking America in 9/11.
Okay, so you're going to talk about the Druze in particular now?
Yeah, so the Druze have communities in those three areas, northern Israel, southern Lebanon, and western and southern Syria. And they have been, after the Alawis were attacked, what happened is Gulani, head of Syria, said, oh no, this is not our people. These are just some people who got out of control. They didn't understand what was happening. And we'll find the guilty people and we'll make sure they get punished. Nothing has ever happened and it's continuing. And now it's moved from the Alawis to the Druze. And the next people are the Kurds, who live also in the northeast of Syria, and they live in the north of Iraq, and they're the original Assyrians from the Bible, the Kurds. The Druze are Arabs, but they're a certain group of Arabs who are kind of like Amish. You could say the Amish are Americans, but they are different, you know, Americans. So there you go. So that's kind of what's happening. There's, again, for those who go on TikTok and stuff like that, there are atrocity snuff films showing what's happening every day there. There was a small group of Protestant Druze. They became Protestants, believers. The whole family was killed, I think about 14 people, including a pastor. People have been thrown out of five-story buildings, marched down the street and shot, being called dogs. And that, and this is kind of going on all the time. Now, Israel has a significant Druze population, 100,000 in the north, and they have family on the other side of the Syrian line. And they're saying, what's happening? Our people are getting slaughtered. You had October 7th. Aren't you going to help us? And Israel said, yes, we are going to help you. So when jihadi forces started moving down toward that area of Suwayda, Israel warned Gulani, said, stop it, or we're going to have to get involved. Nothing was stopped. So they sent air forces to hit, the Israeli Air Force, to hit the armored personnel carriers and tanks, and then they eventually bombed the front gate of the presidential palace in Damascus. And they said, oh, we don't know how it happened. They're not part of our group. We're very sorry. It's going to stop immediately. the massacres were still continuing every day, every day, every day. They would go to the Jews' elders who have these long white beards, and they would literally, like the Nazis did to Jews in Poland, they would actually cut them off with scissors and razors and rip them off and often kill the people afterwards. So, this has been going on, and Israel has now been accused of participating in terrible war crimes against Syria because we're stopping Al-Qaeda from killing Druze and doing genocide against them. That's what you're hearing on Canadian news, basically.
Can you attempt to explain to the Western mind what motivates a group like the leaders of Syria to want to exterminate another people? Why? The Druze tend to be loyal to the local government. If it's, as you said, if it's stable, they keep to themselves. They have no proselytizing philosophy. They're not trying to expand their community in any way, and they're being slaughtered. Like, what drives anyone to do something like that?
This is a great question, and I would say it's a very Western question. Basically, any student of history would say that's really not what happens in history. This view of pacifism and everybody wants to just kiss each other is a post-World War II view, prior to World War I a little bit, but it didn't last long. People, this is the human nature. This is what war is. And when you talk about jihad, this is what jihad is. It's very, very clear. You can read in the Quran, you can read in the Hadith. It says basically strike terror into people, enslave them, kill them, take the women as your fair booty, kill the men if they're not willing to convert. This is what they believe. What is amazing is this can be found on any Google search, and yet people are not aware of it or don't believe it. And so when something like this happens, it's like, where did this come from? Well, it was here yesterday. So people are not really tracking with what's going on in the world, with human nature, and in the Middle East.
And yet Israel keeps getting accused of genocide when it's actually the other side that's genocidal. Israel believes in pluralism and tolerance. And the situation in Gaza is because Israel was attacked by a people that are still committed to repeating October 7th again and again and again. They're trying to stop a genocidal people, and then they're the ones accused of genocide, while the new Syrian regime is more or less left off the hook.
That's true.
When are we going to wake up from this nightmare?
There's an old joke about a man who orders two sides of hummus. And he said, why did you do that? He said, well, because it's homicide. Homicide, genocide. Anyway, my point in all of this is, yes, you're right. The people who did any Israelis who escaped from Hamas, and there were only three of them, they were not handed over to Israel. They were killed. So the whole concept of, hey, all the Germans were good, it was only some Nazis with swastikas who were bad, that's actually not what the British and Americans thought in World War II. And when they went after Leipzig or other towns of, dealing with trying to end the war, or in Japan, they said, hey, you're on the other side. Unless you give up, you're in trouble. No one's saying, let's hand the Israeli hostages over and end the war. They started the war. They don't hand the hostages over. Israel's guilty. It makes perfect sense if you twist it.
So it's, and being here in Canada, we're continually hearing stop the war, release the hostages. But the worldwide community could have pressured Hamas at the beginning to give back those hostages, and that never happened. And that would have.
Isn't it amazing? Isn't it amazing? It's something so clear. Give back the hostages, no battle.
Right.
But that's the point, unfortunately, is the prejudices, anti-Semitism, are so strong, both from Christian roots and Islamic roots that people can't think straight. They're really spun. And it kind of reminds one of Walter, whatever his name was, the famous newspaperman who won the Pulitzer Prize for the New York Times. He went to Stalin's Russia and reported that everything was just like heaven there. And then it only came out afterwards that he hid about the what's called the Holodomor, the mass famines that Stalin was doing in Ukraine so that he could sell Ukrainian wheat for American dollars. And millions of people died and no one paid attention, and the newspaper man got the Pulitzer Prize. It's history repeating itself.
So now let's move to a topic that I've been wanting to get you to speak about this for a long time, and it's in our news more than ever, and it's this thing called settler violence in the West Bank or Judea and Samaria. And I know you could talk for hours on giving the background and then commenting on the occurrence, so it's as succinctly as you can and relevant to what's going on at this time. Can you fill our viewers and listeners in on what's this settler violence all about and what's the proper perspective?
Yes. Well, first of all, we know Jews never sin.
Well, yeah, of course. So
I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah. I knew that.
There are some who sin.
I know I do. You do. We're Jewish.
That's right. In Hollywood movies, they used to talk about who has the black hat and who has the white hat in the Westerns. The black hat, that's the bad guys. The white hat, that's the good guys. The same thing is what the media is doing with settlers. There's a settler community of which there's maybe a few people who are kind of crazy. A few people, right? Like there are some Christians who are racists. Right. But to say that if you're a racist, you're a Christian, that would not be actually accurate.
Can you define settler before you move on?
Give people some
context here.
A settler in Hebrew, it's much easier. Anyone who lives in Israel is a settler. OK, the term is used today to say people who are living on the other side of the Green Line, which was a ceasefire line in 1948 or 67. But a settler literally is anyone who settles. It's a term the Bible uses for Jews living in Israel, mityashev. So it's actually Jews who are living in the promised land. Now, years ago, people said Jews shouldn't live in the promised land. They shouldn't live in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or Haifa. But now that they're living there, now they can't live in the rest of the promised land that God promised them. And even some Christians who believe in the Bible have not thought about this. They're saying, oh, if you leave Tel Aviv, somehow you're crossing into like the Berlin Wall to another area. This is all part of the land God promised us. Now, I used to live on the east side of Jerusalem in Ma'ale Adumim. So you could say I was a settler. It was a bedroom community of Jerusalem. But what's happened is the world has taken, or the media, and said Jews are not allowed to live in the promised land. Good Jews in Tel Aviv, bad Jews 10 miles east of Tel Aviv. And having said that, there are those who have a biblical vision. Okay, they see what the Bible says, and they say, I'm an Orthodox Jew, and I don't want to just live in Tel Aviv. I'd like to live in the rest of the promised land because God is restoring us to the whole land. And the world says, you can't do that. That belongs to another nation. Well, when did that nation ever be a state? It never was a state. Palestine never was a state. But they're saying, no, we know that you can't live there. Therefore, if you live there, you're evil. Now, there are some Orthodox Jews, not many, but some, who maybe wouldn't be that friendly to me and maybe not that friendly to some Arabs. There are a lot more Arabs who wouldn't be that friendly to me, but there are some Arabs who are very friendly with me. So I'm not going to say all Arabs are this way or all Jews are that way, but the media does that. And so we're talking settlers, we're talking about the promised land that God promised Abraham, but don't you dare live in it. Why? Because we think it's wrong. Or falsely, we think there's going to be peace if you leave it. But we don't understand that according to the jihadi perspective, it doesn't matter where we live, we're fair game.
Let's quickly qualify something here. And you alluded to it, but there's, you know, most people don't understand it. So you refer to the Green Line as the ceasefire line. It's not a border.
67.
There's never been a set border between the territories, some called Judea Samaria, others the West Bank, but that whole area, would I be right that the best way to refer to that area that usually gets called the West Bank as disputed territory?
This reminds me of when Ted Kollek, the mayor of Jerusalem, appeared on Cross Country Checkup in the mid-60s, a Canadian radio program.
This is ancient history.
And he said, what do you think about the occupied Arab territories? He said, I think it's a real, the issue of Arab-occupied territories is very important. He changed the term. Rather than saying it's occupied Arab territories, which means it belongs to the Arabs, he says, no, there are Arab-occupied territories. There are some areas where there's a lot of Arabs. The question is, where are we coming from? Are we coming from the Bible? Do we believe God's promises? Some of us don't. Therefore, we say, no, it shouldn't be Jewish because we decided. But God says, I'm bringing the Jewish people back regardless of what you decide.
Yeah, but I understand that. A lot of people understand that. But what I know we could simply reject how the media does and how people, I do want to try to clarify the misunderstanding in terms of the actual situation on the ground. There's claims over that land. We believe that God has title deeded that land to the Jewish people. But currently, there's Arabs living there. There's Jewish people living there. There's some other people living there.
And who would the other people be?
Some Christians that aren't
Jewish. Are Arabs? Christians are usually Arabs. A few of them are Jews.
Right. Are there any non-Arab, non-Jewish Christians living in the disputed territories at all? One or two?
Maybe today there's one and a half.
One and a half. Okay. That goes back to Solomon's say, but never mind.
Here's the question. Let me try to answer your question.
Please.
You're saying, let's throw the Bible out. Let's look at it from a secular point of view. How do secular people look? Well, some people may say the inadmissibility of land conquered in war, like Texas or like Canada. Actually, both countries were conquered in war. So who do we give them back to? We just feel bad. We don't give it back to anybody. So the issue here is, did nations try to destroy Israel? Yes, five nations in one war, 23 in another. They tried to destroy us. We had the bad sense to win. And now we win. We say, okay, we can take land based on war because you tried to destroy us. Oh, no, that's illegal. Well, that's not the way the world works, period. Okay. Now, if you're Russia and you're America, certainly the world doesn't work that way. But if you're Israel, the world's going to try to push. So I think that's just important to realize from a secular point of view. Yeah, we won. So that's the result of us winning a war, which was a genocidal war waged against us from five nations and then 23 nations. So that's part of it. That's one part of the answer. The other is, are we caring for the land? Do we have, this is, you do the archaeology, you open up, you see Jews were living here 1,500 years ago, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago. You can't occupy your own country. And this is something that no one's talking about historically. So here we have history, here we have war, here we have who's treating the land well, and here you have groups which are trying to commit genocide against us. So it's not a factual and it's not a logical issue. There's an anti-Semitic issue set on fire by the pit of hell. Even if you don't believe in hell, it really looks that way. And even people who don't believe in God sometimes believe in hell. So here we go.
Right. And I do believe that we need to approach this from a biblical and a real situation.
Sure.
But even within that, we live in a broken world. We have to navigate the broken world, including whatever the reasons are, good, bad, or other. There are towns in Judea and Samaria that the government of Israel doesn't let Israelis go to. That's part
that's
of the
not, reason. That's not, no, that's not exactly true. That's not exactly
okay,
true.
There
are towns in Area A. There's areas A, B, and C. Area A is fully under Palestinian Authority control. There's a sign up there in red with white letters saying, if you're an Israeli, we advise you not to go in here. You can still go in there. There's nobody going to stop you. If there's a case of people who are going to shoot you and something happened maybe a day or two ago, there would be soldiers who are saying, we advise you not to go there. Sometimes they'll say, hey, don't go there right now. Okay, but it's not a situation of Israelis can't go. On the other hand, Arabs from that area can go to Israel for the most part. And there's a lot of people. Yesterday, 17 were caught in a bus coming to work illegally in Israel. So, yeah, there are problems there, but it's not exactly as you said. I can travel right beside Hebron. Okay, I can go into Area C and Area B, and I don't particularly want to go into Area A because people want to kill me there. So to say Israel doesn't allow you isn't exactly the fact. It's more like people want to kill me when I go there. I used to go there all the time. I was a tour guide for 20 years. I was all over the West Bank, all over Israel, right? And it's actually the same thing biblically, but anyway, yeah. So
In the mind from an Israeli perspective, how are the people that live in that part of the land, how does Israel see them? Do they see them as any different from yourself living on your side of the Green Line?
It's kind of like, do Jews and Arabs like to live together? Now, how many Jews live in Saudi Arabia? None. How many Jews live in Syria? None. How many Jews live in Lebanon? A handful. Why is that? Well, because the Jews there were either massacred or were forced to leave. So in Israel, you have cities like Jaffa, Tel Aviv, like Haifa, and like Jerusalem, where even Tiberias, where you have mixed Jewish Arab population. But the tendency is most Arabs don't want to live with Jews. And this is a whole Islamic thing, and there's a lot of different issues involved. And many Jews, especially Jews who've come from Arab countries where they've lived with Arab people, say, hey, these people massacred my relatives. I don't really want to be in such a situation again. So it's not a Pollyanna Goldilocks type of thing. You're dealing with wars in the Middle East where Jews have been slaughtered. Right now, there's nearly no Jews in any Arab country.
For our listeners, it wasn't always that way. There were major Jewish communities in those countries.
Yeah.
Until it became impossible.
Exodus. 750,000 Jews were kicked out of Arab countries in 1948 to 1956. No one's talking about that because Israel took them in and blessed them.
Right. And they weren't forever refugees like the so-called Palestinians are. Back again. So you mentioned about the word settler. Everyone in Israel is technically a settler, but what makes the people on the other side of the Green Line identified in that way, and why have they been given a bad reputation by the media?
Well, I would say that both the media and the people on the other side of the line are coming from the same place, which is they don't feel Jews have any right to be in that area. There's very interesting clips done by people who've gone into Ramallah and have interviewed people, and they say, what if Jews don't live in the West Bank? Is that all right? And they said, no. They need to be gone from all of Israel. Okay? Very clear, like all kinds of people. So it's not like if we only don't bother them, they won't get angry with us. No, they're angry. They've been angry for a long time. And it's religious, it's based on the beliefs of what it says in the Quran and the Hadith.
Sorry, I had to put the volume back on. So we're back again. You mentioned right at the beginning of this segment that there, just like all people, there's some bad apples within our community, just like any other community. And is that the answer to the settler violence problem?
There's not much of a settler violence problem. There are occasional things. If you actually could put a chalkboard up and say, how many rocks are thrown at buses and cars and kids, how many shootings are going on against Jewish people driving on those roads versus how many settlers have done this, you'd find that it's probably like a 95% to 5%. But it doesn't make the news in the same way because the news says you've got the black hat, you've got the white hat. The Palestinians are the white hats, the Jews are the black hats, It's connected to the God of Israel, who's a nasty God. If you want to do theologically, this brings you right back to Marcion from the second century, who said, get rid of the Jews, get rid of the Old Testament. The God of Israel is a vindictive God. And that effect of Marcion still is live for us today in the church.
Okay, so basically it's a lens of anti-Semitism that's causing a skewed view of the situation.
And it's colored by jihadi beliefs, yes.
Yeah, and I would encourage people, if you are interested in this subject, to dig a little deeper and see what things are actually reported as quote-unquote settler violence. It's not exactly what the media makes it look to be.
A good example, by the way, in Gaza, they said the Jews rocketed an Arab hospital. Israel presented the signals intelligence recordings of Islamic Jihad saying, oh, it's our rocket, we just hit a hospital.
And right.
How many people in the news are aware that that was distorted? It's like the casualties are all from what they call Gazan Health Ministry, which is a Hamas health ministry. So, you know, it's like getting your news from the Nazi high command.
Right. There's a, I don't know, is it a weird part of me that I, on some hand, I maybe I shouldn't feel bad for people being fed lies and believing lies. Most people don't have the time. A lot of people don't have the wherewithal to do the work to break through some of this stuff. I was watching a TED talk from the TED gathering in Vancouver in the spring. And he basically told people, get off social media. It's not helping you. To know what's really going on actually takes work, and the media, and even the traditional media, new media, often hinders more than helps.
Yeah, that's partially true. It's kind of like television. Some people used to say that about television, and certainly television can have a very negative influence. But ultimately, it's how you use television. Now, what he pointed out, that person, is that it takes a lot of work to know. And the fact of the matter is, we are like 1936 in Nazi Germany, as far as the media is concerned. It's very hard to figure out what's happening. We're being sold a line. One has to study. Now, praise God, there's internet. One can search, but most people don't have the time. And so most people then are imbibing the Kool-Aid, and the Kool-Aid kind of has a swastika on it.
Yeah. Well, thank you again, Avner, for taking the time to do this. I know you've been very busy doing things like this. When you read Avner's newsletters, you know he puts a lot of work into what he shares. You could hear that in some of the what I often think are simple questions, and then he gives a lot of great background. It does take a lot of work, and Avner's willing to do that work. So I do recommend you signing up for his newsletter, and I'm going to put, as usual, that information in the description. So again, Avner, thank you so much. May God's blessing be upon you and your family, and continue to give you all the strength and the chutzpah you need to keep on going.
It's great to be with you, Alan, as always. Blessings on you, your family, and Canada.
Thank you so much. So as I said, if you haven't done so already, I encourage everyone to sign up for Avner's newsletter. You could do so by going to his website, which is davidstent.org. That's davidstent.org, davidstent.org. And on just about any page there's a form where you can sign up, and I don't think you will regret that. Also, if you haven't yet subscribed to my YouTube channel, please do so right now. Also, feel free to comment. Please like and review and so on. If you want to contact me directly, you can do so by emailing me at comments@thinkingbiblically.org. And I would really appreciate if you would consider supporting my teaching work. Thanks to those who are already doing so, it'd be wonderful if you would consider doing that. And so, until next time, this is Alan Gilman with Thinking Biblically.